I'm Dr. Alison Grimaldi, and today's podcast is part two of a three-part series of an interview I recorded with Dr. Patrick Weinrau, orthopaedic surgeon, on the topic of hip osteoarthritis. In part one, we discussed all the considerations underpinning an answer to the common question, "Is it time yet?" from patients considering total hip replacement or resurfacing. In part two, we move on to discuss non-surgical options for management of hip OA, with a particular emphasis on medical options. This includes short-acting therapies, usually oral pharmaceuticals, and long-acting therapies, such as injectable pharmaceuticals or radiofrequency neurotomy. This podcast will provide non-medical health professionals with a better understanding of a blended approach to non-surgical management of hip OA, and the relative indications, risks, and benefits of the available pharmaceuticals and injectables. For those of you who missed the guest introduction in part one, there's a more detailed bio in the podcast notes, but in brief, Dr. Patrick Weinrau is an orthopaedic surgeon in Brisbane who focuses exclusively on the management of hip joint disorders with a high level of experience and expertise in a full range of surgical procedures. He's also an associate professor at the Griffith University School of Medicine, has published over 50 peer-reviewed scientific papers, and is the deputy editor for the International Journal of Advanced Joint Reconstruction. So let's get started.
So for people who are not eligible or ready for hip replacement surgery, could you tell us about the other options that you as an orthopaedic specialist have to offer and when and why those options might be useful?
So the first thing to say is that non-surgical treatment very consistently works, and we have a high expectation that with a coordinated program of non-surgical management, that patients will often receive worthwhile benefit. The degree of benefit may be variable, and that's determined by limitations on what we can provide to patients because of their particular circumstances. For instance, there might be some medications they don't agree with, or some options that they're not suitable for, and also determined by the degree of wear and the amount of dysfunction they've got. So if someone's got really severe wear with very significant symptoms, whilst we can be confident we might be able to reduce their symptoms to a point, it may still in fact not be to the state of their satisfaction, right? But pretty much always I think that we are looking at initially starting up at some form of non-surgical therapy program for the vast majority of patients. So when we think about non-surgical therapy, the best way of thinking about it is a blended approach. And if we rely just on one strategy, we're only going to get so far. So generally, if we're going to commit to the process, we usually have to look at a number of different strategies in combination. So that will look like, for instance, a combination of activity modification, maybe some exercise prescription, some strength and conditioning exercises to be able to support the musculature, together with some form of long-acting therapy, which is generally injectable, and then some form of short-acting therapy, which we use for intermittent flares of symptoms, which is generally pharmaceutical tablets. So often if we want to be able to get the best result, we'll combine all three of those. Yep. So from an injectable standpoint, there are a number of different options that we have. The role of an injectable therapy generally is to reduce the overall symptoms. If you have an injection into the hip, you're still going to experience symptoms, and you're still going to get up and down symptoms. So you're still going to get flares from time to time, but what we'll see is that the overall symptoms will be drawn back. So a common injection that many people have had before coming to see me, for instance, might be a corticosteroid injection. Corticosteroid injection does work consistently. It does have some limitations. The first limitation of a corticosteroid is that it probably doesn't last all that long. We would see maybe symptom relief for maybe 2 or 3 months or something like that. So in the longer scheme of things, if you're talking about a chronic musculoskeletal condition, to obtain 2 or 3 months worth of symptom relief or improvement, whilst it's useful for that portion, it probably doesn't have much of a role in the bigger scheme of things, but because then you're in the scenario of potentially going down the road of repeatedly injecting, and there are some significant downsides to that. The scenario where I would use corticosteroid injections for the management of hip osteoarthritis is where I've got a patient who has been relatively good for a long period of time and then has come to me with a really severe exacerbation, and we've just got to get on top of that, on top of those acute symptoms. So they've had an acute severe flare of symptoms, and we're trying to get them just a short-term fix to be able to get them over that hump in the hope that indeed they will be on the other side of it back to where they were. So we might use it for acute exacerbation and symptoms. Or alternatively, in a scenario where we're diagnostically uncertain, where the patient may have, say, for instance, groin and thigh pain, but we're not sure whether it may be hip joint or it might be spinal pathology, and they've got imaging modalities to be able to prove both, and we're uncertain as to what the relative contribution of the hip is, then we may, for instance, do a steroid injection mixed with a local anesthetic for a diagnostic purpose, and it also has a therapeutic result going forward. If we want to get a longer result from an injectable therapy, generally we're going to be talking about things other than corticosteroid though. And so that would be where I would recommend patients towards viscosupplementing. So viscosupplementing has been around for quite a long time. The results are modest. So we get probably about a 30% reduction in symptoms, maybe at most 40%. It's variable in symptom relief in terms of duration, but generally a lot longer than corticosteroids. So somewhere in the order of between 6 and 18 months is what we generally see. And there are a couple of different types of pharmaceutical that we can inject. Duralane, Euflexa, and Synvisc are the common ones that are used in Australia. And some patients have already had this before with their knee osteoarthritis management. There are some other longer term therapy injectables that are starting to become a little bit more popular. For instance, platelet-rich plasma is something that's started to become a little bit more popular. My feeling on platelet-rich plasma is that it's probably a little bit overused. I think that the scope of its use has been extended probably a little bit too far, and the pendulum does need to come back a little bit. I'm not so sure about its role in osteoarthritic wear management. I think that there are definite roles in chronic tendinopathy in some patients, so I think it's got a useful role in some of those patients, but the evidence base supporting its use in the management of osteoarthritis is pretty early data, and certainly it hasn't been proven to be more effective than viscosupplement. So we do both here, but our tendency is to use viscosupplement because it's got a, I think, a lot more track record. We do PRP injections probably more for our patients with tendinopathy. The last sort of injectable therapy or injectable-like therapy that you could consider is what's called radiofrequency ablation or radiofrequency neurotomy. This is a relatively new procedure around the hip. It's only probably in the last 5 or 6 years that we've had an adaption of the probe technology to allow us to be able to do radiofrequencies effectively in the hip. and in the knee, actually. So radiofrequency neurotomy is used in a wide variety of other applications in medicine. In the musculoskeletal space, it's used quite a lot for the management of chronic back pathologies, but it's also used in other scenarios as well. The procedure involves placing a needle which has got an electrified tip quite close to the hip joint, and we ablate or destroy the sensation nerves that come out of the hip joint in targeted locations. So we can't completely desensitize the joint, so we can't get all of them, but we can get some of the main contributors. So the patient doesn't end up having a desensate joint, they have a reduced sensation joint. And so that's probably when radio frequency is added to viscosupplement, we tend to find that it lasts maybe a little bit longer and probably that touch more effective than viscosupplement alone. For me though, radio frequency is probably best done in a hospital under a general anaesthetic though. So there is the downside of needing to bring a patient in for a more formal intervention, whereas something like viscosupplementing is so easy to do, and that can just be done in a clinic location under ultrasound guidance. So we tend to do that far, far more often. So radio frequency, I tend to use sparingly for very specific scenarios, and those scenarios might be, for instance, where a patient has very severe arthritic wear but they're medically unfit for joint replacement surgery, for instance, and they're not responding to a number of our other non-surgical management strategies, and so we might use this as an alternative.
Great, okay, that makes sense. Do you mind just describing a little bit more about the viscosupplementation in terms of, for people who aren't that familiar with it, what it is and what it does?
Yeah, so viscosupplementing is a pharmaceutical that we inject directly into the hip joint. It's absorbed by the lining of the hip joint, what we call the synovial lining, and it stimulates the cells of the synovial lining to produce their own lubricant a little bit thicker, so it increases the viscosity of the synovial fluid within the joint. The effect of viscosupplementing is only limited to the joint that we inject, and because we are waiting for a biologic response, i.e. we're waiting for the joint to be stimulated to make that synovial fluid thicker, there is a lag time or delay in the effect. So generally speaking, we see that the clinical reduction in symptoms is about 50% of the way towards its maximal effect at about 6 weeks, and usually by about 3 months, what you see is what you get, and that would be the maximal clinical effect as seen in that delayed fashion.
Okay, great. And how long would we expect that to last then, that effect?
Yeah, so not everybody responds. So some people, they're non-responsive to it. Most people do respond. So the majority would, and the clinical effect is somewhere between 6 and 18 months, I say to people. We do see a lot of people though in whom we also got to understand that hip osteoarthritis, the pain that you get is not static. So that the natural history of the pain that you would experience is one of a meandering course. So for instance, we might see someone where they've got quite bad symptoms, give them a viscosupplement injection, it settles them down, and the viscosupplement might last, for instance, 12 months, but at the end of that 12 months, even though the medication has now worn off in effect, they're at the position where actually their hip symptoms naturally, the baseline has actually gone back into a more quiet state. And so they might come back years and years later and they say, oh, listen, that viscosupplement was awesome. It lasted me 3 years. And you go, well, actually, I can't take credit for that. Probably the fact is that your hip's actually going pretty well.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. So in terms of then frequency and the number of injections, so both with the corticosteroid and the viscosupplementation, is there, a maximum number that you can have and a minimum time frame for repeat injection?
Yeah, so I don't think that there's like firm guidelines on this, but what I would say is that corticosteroid injections in the hip joint should be used sparingly, and so they should be used only in specific circumstances where we're trying to get short to medium term relief of significant exacerbations. Once that wears off, I think to repeat those corticosteroids again and again and again is probably not a rational way in terms of long-term management for a chronic condition. For viscosupplementing, I usually say to people, if you haven't received about a six-month period of really worthwhile symptom relief, then I think we're going down the wrong track. Yeah, so it would be uncommon that I would inject people at 6 monthly intervals. I say to people that we don't usually have a time frame placed on when or if they should come back for an injection. It's more open-ended. So for instance, if we've done an injection for a person and they've come back to see us at the 3 month mark and they're saying, listen, actually things are going pretty well, then I say to them, listen, come back, you know, when your symptoms start to feel that they're deteriorating again and the tablet therapies are not working for you anymore. And then they might come back like a year down the track or something like that. So, but if you're needing to inject a viscosupplement more than 6 monthly, I think that you're going down the wrong path. There would have to be mitigating circumstances that would need to justify you to go onto that. And sometimes there are. Sometimes there might be, you know, social circumstances or, you know, work scenarios where you are pushing that therapy a little bit more aggressively. But in most situations, if you're needing to do regular therapy like that, then maybe that's one of the indicators that you might use to be able to say, listen, you know, we're probably at the point where joint replacement has to be considered here.
Great. And is there any risks or contraindications that need to be considered for either of those injections?
So with viscosupplementing, there are some viscosupplements that have avian proteins within them. And so if you've got somebody who's got an allergy to chicken or egg, then they probably best off not use with that particular pharmaceutical. There are other types that are non-avian, and you could use those pharmaceuticals instead.
So corticosteroid risks and contraindications?
Yeah, so that's a good question, because I do occasionally see people who have come to me and they've had a lot of corticosteroid injections because they've felt that it's been effective. So they've had an injection, it's been really good, and then effect's worn off, so they've gone back for another, and it's just like this cycle that they've sort of been in. Yeah? So if they've had a couple of injections here and there over the last few years, that's fine. There's no, I think sparingly used, I think that it's like most things in life. It's not necessarily you should use them all the time or you should use them none of the time. It's always sort of it's somewhere in between. Yeah, so there's a rational use. And so for me, I think that intermittently or occasionally, that's okay. The downside of corticosteroid is that there is concern relating to whether the steroid itself has a detrimental effect upon the cartilage within the joint, and it may accelerate the degree of wear. There's also a theoretical concern any time that we inject a hip joint or place a needle in a person's body that you can introduce infection. Although the infection risk is low, the more frequently you do the injections, the higher the risk.
Great. Okay, thanks. I think that's given us some good information on all those injections. What about oral medications? Do you have recommendations for your patients about oral medications?
Yeah, so oral pharmaceuticals form, a really important part of the overall management, non-surgical management package. I say to people that oral pharmaceuticals are the short-acting therapies that we use in the armamentarium. So we've got exercise prescription, physiotherapy and conditioning. We've got long-acting therapies which are generally injectable, which sort of pull your symptoms down. And then for your flares, for your ups and downs, for your intermittent symptoms that you might get day to day or week to week, then that's where you use your oral pharmaceuticals. The idea of an oral pharmaceutical is more to be able to treat symptoms on the day. So where you might be doing a particular pursuit or an activity, or you might be experiencing increasing symptoms for whatever reason, and that's where you'll use your oral pharmaceuticals to be able to suppress those flaring of symptoms. Now, if you're needing to take oral pharmaceuticals at high doses regularly, then we're probably heading down the wrong path. We need to start thinking about blending some of those other strategies maybe a bit more proactively. So if you're needing to take, for instance, an anti-inflammatory tablet continuously to be able to suppress your symptoms, then there will be risks associated with that. And they might be, for instance, for people with sensitive stomach, they might have gastrointestinal upset or ulcer formation. They also, for instance, people with asthma might have worsening of asthma symptoms. And so the side effect profile of an oral pharmaceutical increases with the degree of dose and the duration of therapy. So what we're trying to achieve is better longer term suppression of symptoms by other methods and then using the oral pharmaceuticals for intermittent breakthrough discomfort. And so in that space, what I would say is that I have a lot of people who are like quite polarized in this space. So they'll come in and say, listen, I just don't take tablets, right? And you say, well, listen, that's actually up to you. That's fine. There's no problems with that. And it's your choice. But what you might consider is taking them selectively, right? Where you might use them intermittently, where you're trying to, for instance, go for a 20K bushwalk and you know you're going to get some symptoms and you might be able to perform a bit better with a bit more comfort if you take tablets on that day, right? Doesn't necessarily need to take them for the rest of the day. So I always talk about a pharmaceutical holiday, right? So where it's okay to take your tablets for a couple of days or a couple of weeks, if your symptoms are flared up and you're overseas on a walking holiday in Italy and it's up and down, up and down a lot of stairs and things like that, take them for a couple of weeks. That's no problems. You're not likely to get any side effects or long-term detriment from that. But when you're back home and you're maybe a little bit more sedentary and your symptoms have settled down, then stop, right? Because you don't need them then. So you titrate the use of the pharmaceuticals according to the symptoms. The other thing that I think a lot of people, there's a sort of misnomer is that you need to take these tablets continuously to get an effect. Where, for instance, you need to take an anti-inflammatory tablet all the time or else the inflammation comes back. And whilst that might have maybe some merit from a histologic point of view, I think that from a practical point of view, I think you're very, very safe just to take them on an intermittent basis. And that's how I usually recommend they're used. On the pharmaceutical space, the over-the-counter medications are good, right? So you can choose to take, Voltaren or Nurofen. The prescription oral anti-inflammatories do have some advantages though. The first advantage is that they're generally long-acting therapies. So they're sustained release so that they provide a patient with a clinical effect over a 24-hour period, as opposed to say, for instance, a 6 or 8 hour period, so that we generally get better clinical result. We also find that compliance with the appropriate dosing regime for that particular medication is better if you just need to take it once a day as opposed to sort of 3 or 4 times a day. The other advantage of the prescription ones is that you generally can prescribe those in which are maybe a little bit more stomach friendly. So the less specific medications like, for instance, Voltaren or Nurofen, do tend to have a slightly higher risk of stomach upset, as opposed to, for instance, pharmaceuticals like Celebrex or Mobic. And so the prescription ones do have some advantages. The other aspect of pharmaceutical management is that Often you get better results when you blend pharmaceuticals as well, so we call that polypharmacy. So I often tell a person, if you are going to reach for an anti-inflammatory tablet, then you should also consider simultaneously taking some form of paracetamol product, right? And paracetamol products are really well tolerated. The downside of paracetamol products is that they're not super strong. So people say to me, well, I've got this really, really outrageously 10 out of 10 hip pain, and I took a Panadol tablet and my pain didn't go away, so therefore Panadol doesn't work. And the answer is, well, maybe on its own it's not strong enough, but in combination, every little bit counts. So if you can get a 5 or 10% improvement with something simple like a paracetamol product, and you add that on with some of your other strategies, then in fact it does have some merit. Paracetamol is very well tolerated for the vast majority of people, and it's got a very, very low side effect profile. So it's a really useful adjunct management strategy that I would recommend for most people. The biggest downside of paracetamol is that you generally need to take it quite frequently. And so, because the half-life is short. So to get a clinical effect, it's really only for a short period of time. So you need repeated dosing for it to be truly effective. And that's where some of the longer-acting paracetamol preparations are starting to become quite popular, things like Panadol Osteo.
Yeah, great. And just one other thing about oral, well, not medications, but supplements. So patients often ask us about glucosamine, or now the curcumin or fish oil, chondroitin. Are you aware of any evidence around them, or have you seen any benefits?
Yeah, so there's lots of options in this space. So it depends on which one we're talking about. And there seems, pretty much every time I look on the internet, there's another one, right? So there's quite a lot of options in this space. So what I would say is that most of these things are generally safe, right? So the side effect profile from a lot of these styles of therapies is low, so a lot of people have already tried them. All right, so by the time they've come to me, they've already started. A lot of people will be on sort of 2 or 3 adjunctive over-the-counter supplementary medications. Yeah, probably the ones that are most commonly seen, I think, are either glucosamine or fish oil. The evidence base surrounding those two options is weak. So there's been quite a lot of studies done on glucosamine now, both in the hip and more so in the knee. The overall consensus is that it probably doesn't have much of an effect. If it did have an effect, it would be small. But I don't dissuade a person who wishes to take an adjunctive medication like that. I just say to them, listen, there's probably not a lot of evidence to support it strongly.
That wraps up part 2 of this interview series. If you visit the blog page, the podcast notes are available for review, and there's another useful infographic summarising the relative roles, advantages and risks of the pharmaceutical and injectable options for the management of hip OA. And a reminder that if you're not signed up to the newsletter, sign up today to ensure you don't miss the last of this great series, which will be a video interview that explores the different prostheses, surgical approaches and their indications. Don't forget to take a look around the DrAlisonGrimaldi.com site, where you'll find a wealth of clinically applicable information on all things hip. See you there!